Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the arrest at JFK Airport yesterday of George Nader on charges of, quote, transporting visual depictions of minors engaged in sexually explicit conduct. Nader is the go-between and fixer between Trump and Jared Kushner and the Emirati leader MBZ and the Saudi Crown Prince MBS. And he testified extensively to Robert Mueller and is mentioned over 100 times in the Mueller report. David Hurst, the editor of the Middle East Eye, joins us from London to discuss the amazing network this three-time convicted pedophile created between Trump and Kushner and the Gulf Arab potentates, a major fundraiser for the Trump campaign, Elliot Broidy, and Israeli private intelligence operatives. Nader also tried to set up a back channel between Trump and the Kremlin, brokering a January the 11th, 2017 meeting in the Seychelles between Putin's friend and head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund, Kirill Dmitriev, and Blackwater founder and brother of Trump's Secretary of Education, Eric Prince. We'll assess whether Nader, who clearly did not know of the sealed indictment against him, was set up with kiddie porn planted on his phone, and if Nader will provide more embarrassing information against Trump, having named someone in the Trump orbit who contacted Dmitriev on the night Trump won the presidency with the text, Putin won. Then, with the murderous Janjaweed militia massacring pro-democracy protesters in Sudan, with the backing of the Saudis and the Emiratis, we will speak with Steve Howard, a sociologist who recently returned from Sudan, where he was a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women. He joins us to discuss how MBS, MBZ, and Egypt's Sisi are determined to extinguish democratic aspirations in Sudan, just as they quashed the Arab Spring. And that as long as Trump and Kushner are their best friends, the people of Sudan will never have the freedom they recently won in ousting Sudan's longtime dictator, General Bashir. Then finally, we'll look into Trump's war on worker rights, which flies in the face of the populist campaign Trump waged as a friend of the worker. Now he is reneging on the federal minimum wage raise he promised, cutting overtime, allowing employees to fire workers based on sexual orientation, and endangering workplace safety by gutting OSHA while filling the National Labor Relations Board with anti-union members and stacking the Supreme Court with anti-worker justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. An historian of labor, Eric Loomis, joins us to discuss these alarming trends for working Americans. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from London is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian and The Guardian's former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow Bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hi.
So, David, what do you make of the arrest at JFK yesterday of George Nader, who was apparently coming to the United States for some medical treatment, and he was arrested at Kennedy Airport and charged with transporting visual depictions of minors engaged in sexually explicit conduct, which is apparently a habit of George Nader's. But apparently the video was found on one of his three phones that were confiscated when the FBI arrested him back at Dulles Airport in January 17 of 2018, and subsequent to that, they arrested him. Actually, they were working for Robert Mueller, the FBI team, and George Nader turned out to be very cooperative in terms of the Mueller report. His name shows up more than 100 times in the report. So my understanding is that they sealed the indictment back then when they arrested him, and he must not have known about it, I'm assuming. Otherwise, why would he have shown up in the United States? Is that your understanding?
Yes. I mean, I don't want to pretend knowledge that I don't have. And there is obviously quite a lot of conflicts of interest going along. And there could be what we would call plea bargaining as well. NADA has been in this position before where he has used his cooperation with the U.S. government to get off charges. He's been on... He's a convicted paedophile, and there have been many, many instances in the past, German authorities, Czech authorities, American authorities as well. So it's a habit he can't kick, and it's been used as a form of leverage for information which is actually much more important to the Mueller inquiry, and that is the contacts between Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ, who's Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, and Trump. And NADA was a key go-between, a back channel that established that relationship very, very early on, long before Trump, in fact, was a candidate in the last election. And that was Mueller's inquiry. And Mueller was really interested in particularly the Russian end of that inquiry, how NADA introduced a Russian businessman at a key meeting in the Seychelles. You've got to remember that everyone in this particular play has, or every player has got their own motivation for wanting to seek to get closer to Trump. And Mueller was primarily focusing on the Russian motivation. But there was a very clear motivation that came with a clear use for NADA, and that was to establish really the key connection in the Middle East and also in American foreign policy, and that is between a tiny group of basically Sunni dictators and Trump himself, and both are profiting from that relationship. Now, although mayhem is happening in the Middle East as a result, that's the key relationship, and NADA was the NADA was basically the switchboard that set that relationship up.
Well, you, in terms of NADA's dealings with the intelligence services and being forgiven for his pedophilia, apparently in 1991 he was charged on pedophilia here in the United States, sentenced to 6 months in jail, but the records in that case were sealed because apparently he'd been assisting the U.S. government in secret matters. And then, of course, in December of 2016, shortly after Trump's election, NADA set up the meeting with UAA officials and Trump campaign aides. And that, of course, that happened in Trump Tower, and that got the attention of the Obama administration because MBZ had violated diplomatic protocols by showing up without letting the State Department know that he was in the country. So that's just filling in a couple of the blanks there. And what you just referred to then in terms of mayhem in the Middle East, David, you wrote a piece recently about what's happening in Sudan, and there was a massacre of protesters by the Janjaweed militia. And all of this is happening, of course, on the orders of the general in charge of this so-called transition that the protesters they consider a hoax on the part of the military. But the key to understanding the situation in Sudan surely is, and as your article points out, it's the UAE, the Emiratis, and the Saudis, and Sisi in Egypt, that are backing this horrible military government in Sudan because they don't want something that resembles the Arab Spring breaking out again, particularly in Sudan. Is that your...
Consistently, the policy has been the same, and it's the same actors, and it's the same policy, and it's one that Trump endorses. Even before Trump became president, this group of people, or this group of countries, and we've also got to include Israel in this, by the way, because another of NADA's usefulness to the Gulf states was to introduce them to Israel through a guy called Elliot Brody, who runs several Israeli companies. So they're doing the same thing, basically, and they've been doing the same thing ever since the coup in Egypt in June 2013. In each country they go, it doesn't really matter which country we're talking about, it's Egypt or Libya, Yemen, and now indeed Sudan. They are trying to install their man, right, who is a dictator, who completely ruthless militarily. It's generally a military man in each case. In Libya, it's Khalifa Haftar in Egypt, it's Sisi, and here it's a guy called Hemeti, who used to run the Janjaweed. He's not one of the five people named in the ICC war crimes on Darfur, but the UN names him as a person of interest. Now, what's going on in Sudan is quite interesting in the sense that the coup was against an Islamist who turned dictator, so that you have quite a few forces on the civilian side of the barriers or the barricades in Khartoum who were either communists or they were former supporters of Saddam Hussein. They were not Islamists. Right? They were secular. And they wanted a civilian government that would start doing away with all the Islamists in Bashir's regime. But because Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Egypt want their man in, they don't care about who's who in this situation. That what they don't want is democracy. It's not an Arab Spring as such anymore. It's they don't want people expressing their own opinion in the civilian government, even though the civilians in Khartoum were basically anti-Islamists, which of course they are as well. So this is, again, this transcends, this mania that they've got transcends the divide in the Arab world between Islamism, political Islam, which remains still very popular, and secular politics, purely secular politics. It's all about now control and their control. And Sudan's a very, very important country. Israel is extremely interested in what goes on in Sudan because a lot of the weapons produced in Sudan end up in Gaza and also in Libya as well. And so there are a lot of outside forces here who want to actually control the what would be a normal civilian process in Sudan. These guys are so crazy that it's not about Islamism anymore, it's not about secularism anymore, it's about establishing complete control. And they're repeating exactly the same formula in a whole different set of theatres.
And again, I'm speaking with David Hurst, who is in London. He's the editor of Middle East Eye. He was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian and The Guardian's former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent and Ireland correspondent. So back to the arrest of George Nader. Just shortly after he set up the meeting with MBZ in Trump Tower in December 2016 that got the attention of the Obama administration because of MBZ had secretly shown up without violating State Department protocol. Shortly after that, he set up a meeting, Nader, with Eric Prince, the brother of the current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, the founder of the mercenary army Blackwater. That meeting took place in the Seychelles with Vladimir Putin's friend, the oligarch Kirill Dmitriev, who was in charge of Russia's sovereign wealth fund. That meeting, from my understanding, David, did not go well, that they were trying to set up a back channel between the Trump transition team and the Kremlin, but Dmitriev apparently thought that Eric Prince was an idiot and an arrogant idiot at that and didn't want to work with him. What's your understanding of why that meeting went nowhere?
Well, I think you're right. It's partly a question of personality. It's partly a question of ego. Everyone wanted to be the back channel. And it's partly a question of everyone having a very, very different agenda. And we can see this later on. I mean, I think what the meeting didn't go well itself, and Russia used other channels afterwards. But from NBC's point of view, it went extremely well in the sense that he used it as a stepping stone to get to Trump's attention. He used other intermediaries, other American oligarchs to get closer to Trump. And his primary objective was at that time to start promoting an unknown and young prince called Mohammed bin Salman. Oust his elder cousin, who is very, very well known in Washington and liked and trusted by the deep state, the Pentagon, and by the CIA, and install Mohammed bin Salman in the minds of Kushner and Trump as the next go-to person to deal with. And he did that. And it was entirely down to Emirati efforts that sold a Saudi prince to Washington. So they achieved an awful lot. And now we get a... They used that line of communication to sell the idea to Trump. It was a good idea to blockade Qatar. That policy has gone back and forward because Qatar has since done the same thing back and bought influence in Washington and in particularly persuaded Tillerson that this was a rubbish idea. But even now Trump is back, that's backfired on Trump as well. MBZ at the time claimed credit for Tillerson's dismissal, which is the arrogance of his belief that he has this sort of umbilical cord to Trump. So it didn't work for Dmitriev and it personally, but it certainly worked for the Emiratis, and they are now, you know, reaping the rewards of, you know, a total blank sheet as far as the White House is concerned for anything they do.
Well, it wasn't just Tillerson who objected to the Saudi blockade of Qatar. It was the Secretary of Defense, who since resigned. Yeah. He, of course, was protesting because of the obvious. This, the U.S. has this biggest base there.
At the time, I'm told that at the time that he tweeted to say this was a good idea, Trump didn't even know that he had the most important American base based in Qatar and the head of local CENTCOM there. Right. He didn't even know he had an American base in Qatar when he approved of the decision to blockade it.
Sure, and this is the same base where the B-52s just showed up recently in the increasing standoff against Iran. But in April of 2017, Nader, as an advisor of the UAE and of MBZ, he wired $2.5 million to the fundraiser for Trump. I think one of his top fundraisers, Elliot Broidy, then became the finance director of the RNC. And that money was used to pay, $1.6 million of that money was used to pay off a Playmate model who allegedly got pregnant by Elliot Broidy, although the rumor is that it was Trump's child, not his. He's not exactly a matinee idol, Elliot Broidy. So that's what looks like it happened there. That was a major favor to Trump, again, brokered by this pedophile, George Nader, who's clearly ingratiating himself deeply with Trump, if indeed it's true that Broidy did this massive favor for him. So that's how this guy operates, right?
Yeah, no, he at his best, I broke a story about how he had, very early on, I think it was in December 2017, he arranged a yacht summit for quite a few powerful leaders and basically said, if you make yourself into a military force, say, like an Arab NATO, I can sell this to Washington. And part of that summit was one of the people who, there were the obvious characters we've talked about before, but another one was King Abdullah of Jordan. Now, since then, King Abdullah of Jordan has fallen out in a very serious way with the Saudis over Jerusalem and over the Palestinians and over the deal of the century and over basically the Saudi wish, but Mohammed bin Salman's wish to displace Jordan as the custodian of the mosques and the holy places in Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa. And so you can see there that this is basically thieves falling out. They're all highly motivated. They've got their own very particular agenda. Sometimes that agenda comes together, but it very quickly falls apart. And the reason that these associations that we're unraveling and uncovering, and I think there's still five current live Department of Justice investigations into associates of MBZ at the moment. That's as reported by David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times. So this is still live. It's not history. The investigations are still ongoing. But what we see is personal contacts, very, very fluid, very, very small group of people, all secret. Nothing's on paper. There's no policy. There's nothing that's publicly available. There's nothing that can be publicly discussed. Underhand deals involving people, shady people, very rich businessmen. and people trying to spin the world and create their own business and military empires, huge sums of money involved. And there's no discussion of it. There's no record of it. There's no accountability. And yet, massive things are happening as a result of that. So, and Nader, very shady people like Nader, is just sort of one, you know, cog in this wheel. But it's a bad and it's unstable system, because if you take any of these actors away out of this particular machine that's been created, it falls apart, because it's got no consensus, it's got no parliament has debated this, Congress hasn't ratified this, there's no involvement of officials, as I said, there's no records, but chaos is created as a result. And I think what we're doing now, bit by bit, is piecing together the bits that create the most disastrous foreign policy of possibly the most disastrous U.S. president in modern history.
Well, this disastrous U.S. president, of course, thanks to his attorney general acting as his personal lawyer, has been able to dodge a bullet at this point with the Mueller report, in which Nader is mentioned more than 100 times. One of the more tantalizing mentions of Nader is in conjunction with Putin's friend Kirill Dmitriev, the oligarch who's in charge of Russia's sovereign wealth fund. Somebody tweeted to Dmitriev, "Putin won," at the time that Donald Trump won the election. That person is redacted, blacked out in the Mueller report. So it's sort of tantalizing to figure out who that person is. But what's your just sense in closing here of what's going on here? A reliable source of mine just was talking today with the lawyer for Nader, who is asking for a bail hearing today in New York. And the lawyer, not surprisingly, says that Nader was actually set up, that this kiddie porn was placed on his phone by somebody who wanted to have him arrested or embarrassed or neutralized. It's pretty hard to believe anybody was that important as a fixer and a go-between had this record of being a pedophile. So that in itself is pretty extraordinary. But quite often the intelligence services use people who are compromised. But if there's any truth to that, my sense would be that the Trump administration wants George Nader to go away. Who, on the other hand, wants George Nader to get back in the news to further open, pry loose the material that's in the Mueller report that Barr has so successfully obscured? But if you actually read the Mueller report, you realize that Donald Trump is as guilty as sin.
Yeah, well, I mean, Qataris, maybe? I don't know. There would be quite a few people who might be interested in using Nader, pressurizing him more to get more information out of what he knows. He didn't even have just contacts with Brody, with Israel, with the Emiratis. He also was a go-between, was used as a go-between with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, who are now designated terrorists in America. So he had an astonishing facility to move around the map of the Middle East and just pop up everywhere and be trusted as a sort of message bearer, as a back channel. So he's obviously a guy of some great talent, used for nefarious means. And obviously, it's all coming to an end for him. He's also quite a sick man as well. And so he came back. That's why he came back to the U.S. for urgent medical treatment for his heart. So this is the honest answer is I don't think we'll ever get to know the truth of this. And we do know that he's been singing like a canary to Mueller, and maybe someone wants to pressurize him to give just a little bit more information. I think his usefulness now is blown. I don't think he's any more useful as a secret go-between, because now it's all out in the open. It's known how these relationships were set up. I think he performed his function, which was to set up a network of people that are still very much communicating with each other directly now. I mean, how else did Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman get to know each other on first terms and WhatsApp each other late into the night. It was through people like Nader and Broidy. So that network that Nader helped set up now exists, and exists in a very, very tangible form, so that CC or MBZ or MBS, whatever they do, whoever they kill and however gruesome, whatever revulsion there is in Washington, Trump will not basically act against them. And the reason he won't act against them is because of the network that people like Nader set up. So it's worked. The instability of the situation now is that if any of these guys just falls out of the picture, the network collapses. So what we're dealing with is a sort of a group of princes, who all of whom have rejected their wiser elder cousins and wiser institutional insights into world policy. They're making things up as they go along. They're creating mayhem.
Right. Well,
that's network is really unstable.
Right, and that making up things as they go along is exactly what our president's doing too. So they're all peas in the same pod, I guess. I thank you for joining us, David Hurst. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Hurst, who joined us from London. He's the editor of Middle East Eye. He was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian and The Guardian's former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Saudis and the Emiratis are backing the murderous Janjaweed militia who are massacring pro-democracy protesters in Sudan.
So excuse me, mister, but I'm a mister too, and you're giving mister a bad name, mister like you. So I'm taking the mister from out in front of your name. Like you that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like You.
Oh, Akush, arise and shine, raise your flag with the guiding star, and sing a song of freedom with joy, for peace, liberty, and justice shall forevermore reign. So Lord bless our Sudan. So Lord bless our Sudan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Steve Howard, who's a professor and associate director for graduate studies at the Ohio University School of Media Arts and Studies, a sociologist by training whose work focuses on social change in Africa and social movements in the Muslim world. He just recently returned from Sudan, where he was a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women. He's the author of Sudan Scenes from a Youthful Uprising, and his forthcoming book is We Are Mahmoud, On the Path of the Prophet in Unsettled Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Howard.
Thanks very much.
And there was a massacre of the pro-democracy protesters in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The capital is effectively locked down by the Janjaweed militia, whose leader, Hemeti, appears to be the power behind the scenes here and trying to turn back the aspirations of the people who managed to oust the long-time dictator, Omar Bashir. But it does appear that their chances of succeeding against the kind of brutality that the Janjaweed are famous for, particularly in the massacres that they conducted in Darfur, with the Saudi Arabians, with Sisi in Egypt, and with the Emiratis backing the military and the Janjaweed, what's your sense of whether people power can prevail?
I've been terribly impressed and moved over 6 months so far of people power, and I guess we have to say it isn't inexhaustible. They've particularly in that the so-called Muslim generals and dictators and so forth have really desecrated the holy month of Ramadan for the population by killing people and now making a complete farce of the the Eid, the holiday at the end of fasting month, I really think they'll stop at nothing to continue with this, what we can only call another coup in Sudan, and that they don't have much of an intention to turn over power. And particularly when they say that they wouldn't have elections in 9 months, that's ridiculous, really, given the lengths they've gone so far to make sure elections wouldn't take place in 2020 in the first place, and now to imagine they're staging elections in 9 months is kind of beyond belief.
Well, what I find beyond belief is that this relationship between President Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, with MBZ in the Emirates and MBS, the Saudi Crown Prince, in many ways it was set up by this character, George Nader, who's just been arrested at JFK Airport on charges of having child pornography. He's a key guy in setting up that relationship, and that seems to be at the heart of it. We have a president, surely, in Donald Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who just simply don't care about the brutality of these people that they so unswervingly support. I mean, if you can still support Mohammed bin Salman after the murder of Khashoggi, then you're pretty shameless, surely.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, that's without question. Yes.
So what can be done? Are there people in the U.S. government, short of the White House, that can make some kind of stand for democracy?
I guess the signs do point to the lower echelons, including the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, making some pretty strong statements and encouraging or really condemning the military crackdown and the deaths of the protesters and so forth. But I guess I wouldn't be surprised if the next step was to try to get in some sort of particularly African Union force to supervise some sort of oversight of peace talks of some nature. It's hard to imagine what they'd look like at this point, but that seems to be the usual pattern, that the African Union is called in to at least oversee these things, if not bring them to some successful conclusion. Anyway, as a next step.
And again, I'm speaking with Steve Howard, who's a professor and associate director for graduate studies at the Ohio University School of Media and Arts and Studies, a sociologist by training whose work focuses on social change in Africa and social movements in the Muslim world. He just recently returned from Sudan, where he was a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women. He's the author of Sudan, Scenes from a Youthful Uprising, and his forthcoming book is We Are Mahmoud, On the Path of the Prophet in Unsettled Times. But at this point, you've got the Janjaweed militia locking down the capital, Khartoum, killing people indiscriminately, and they appear to be doing so at the behest of the military council led by General Abdelatif Berhan. So once these guys are back in the saddle and prepared to be that ruthless, they're not likely to invite the African Union army in, are they?
No, although they do have all kinds of amazing global connections, in that they were brought to life after the Darfur crisis by the European Union, believe it or not, which gave Sudan all kinds of money to make sure that migrants wouldn't cross through Sudan into Egypt and onto the Mediterranean and Europe. And the Sudan government gave all of that money to strengthen the Janjaweed and rename them as this rapid deployment force to protect Sudan, to monitor the borders. Well, these are the people who are now murdering protesters and complements of the European Union.
So what do you know about the Janjaweed leader, Hemethi? I mean, how much does the military council control him?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting issue because of I'll be curious to see how far it gets because of really kind of rampant Sudanese racism that the people who've controlled the country in every administration, whether military or civilian, since independence have been people from the Nile Valley, people from north of Khartoum or Khartoum itself, and the thought of someone from Darfur becoming head of the government it's really hard to imagine given the way that people from the central part of the country look down on the Darfur people.
And, of course, the South Sudanese as well, right? This is a racism between what would you say, between African-looking people and Arab-looking people. Is that the dichotomy?
Yeah, and I'd say, and when you say African-looking, Arab-looking, I think for the most part, from the outside perspective, it's hard to tell the difference among the Sudanese. But they know who comes from where, and they're the central Sudanese. I love them dearly, but they're kind of remarkable races too about the marginalized ethnic groups outside of this central part of the country.
So
they've marginalized them in terms of education and social stature and so forth. So they haven't had much chance to rise up in the society except through the military.
And Hameti is considered one of these dark-skinned people from Darfur?
Right.
I see. So that might limit his political horizons. What about, though, the Sudanese Professional Association that's been spearheading these protests? Do you think that they're just going to be decimated by the Janjaweed, or do they have... What kind of international support do they have?
It's strictly lip service to the greatest extent. I mean, they're not getting financial backing, but they're certainly noble, well-trained, educated, dedicated, peace-loving, good Muslim people, but without any arms at their disposal. And then, you know, and they're not going to take up arms. That's not their intention. And so I think my guess is that they would just sort of fade into the background and another frustrated sort of, giving up on democracy for now kind of thing if things get more violent. That would be my estimate.
Well, is there any way to shame the Saudis, the Egypt, Sisi, and the Emiratis, who without their support,
well, of course, if the U.S. would rattle some sabers and make some noise about this and condemn what they all are up to, but you know that's not going to happen with the Trump government. They're very cozy with the leader of the Emirates and with Sisi and with MBS and so forth. So that. I can't see that happening. That would be astonishing and very significant, but it doesn't seem like we're going to intervene in that way, unless we get some further public uproar in this country about it. And so I appreciate your talking about it.
Well, just in closing then, these reactionary leaders like Sisi, MBS and MBZ have managed to roll back the clock in Egypt's, of course, flirtation with the Arab Spring and in general.
Yeah.
And if they succeed in Sudan of crushing the democratic aspirations of the Sudanese people, it doesn't say much for that region's hopes for democracy, does it? Even though, you know, political Islam is being promoted by the Qataris, it seems to be alive, but not able to stand up to these reactionary Sunni kings and military generals like Sisi.
Right. I mean, the whole world is becoming very Trump-like, and it needs to end soon.
Well, Steve Howard, I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for calling me.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Howard. He's a professor and associate director for graduate studies at the Ohio University School of Media Arts and Studies, a sociologist by training whose work focuses on social change in Africa and social movements in the Muslim world. He just recently returned from Sudan, where he was a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women. And he's the author of Sudan Scenes from a Youthful Uprising. And his forthcoming book is We Are Mahmoud, On the Path of the Prophet in Unsettled Times. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's war on workers' rights.
I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land. I'd ring out danger, I'd ring out a warning, I'd ring out love between my brothers and my sisters. All over this land. If I had a song, if I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Loomis, a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money on labor and environmental issues. He's the author of Out of Sight, The Long and Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe, Empire of Timber, Labor Unions, and the Pacific Northwest Forests, and his latest book just out, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Loomis.
Thank you for having me.
And Eric, there's a very disturbing editorial in today's New York Times on Trump's war on workers' rights. And in the opening introduction, I mentioned some of them, just that he's reneged on the federal minimum wage raise. He promised he's cutting overtime, allowing employees to fire workers based on sexual orientation and endangering workplace safety by gutting OSHA while filling the National Labor Relations Board with anti-union members and stacking the Supreme Court with anti-worker justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. I guess the first question then would be, do you think the people that voted for him, particularly in those three key states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, the working guys in the Rust Belt, the white working men that seems to be so much a part of Trump's base, have they figured this out? Have they noticed what he promised versus what he's doing?
Well, you know, I think some of them. I think that there is, you know, when we look back at 2016, we have to understand the kind of desperation of the working class in America, especially the industrial working class. And especially in states such as Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, states that have really been racked by deindustrialization, outsourcing, factories closing, and et cetera. And you know, Donald Trump is a liar. And I think that this is the first thing that everyone who has ever dealt with him has known. And he'll say anything just off the cuff. And so, you know, he said a few things that were conceivably pro-worker. But, you know, anybody looking at his personal history knew that he was not pro-worker in any way, shape, or form. I mean, he doesn't even pay his own contractors, for instance. But, you know, Donald Trump also articulated a lot of frustration that large sections of the working class have with the way the economy has gone. And, you know, it's not as if I think that these people really believe that Donald Trump would truly bring back the jobs, for instance. But I think that he was able to at least express their frustrations and connect them to larger issues, because Donald Trump is very effective at finding people to blame. So whether we're blaming immigrants or Democrats or whoever, Donald Trump was able to articulate a very effective strategy here. And whereas Democrats, even though Democrats, whether Hillary Clinton or really anybody else over the last few decades, ultimately are better for those workers than Donald Trump, you know, they were very unable to articulate a real alternative to the problems that these communities face. I mean, ultimately, the problem in places like Youngstown, Ohio, or Flint, Michigan, or anywhere else, is that not only are there not jobs, but there's no plan to bring jobs back there. And unless there are plans to bring jobs back there, demagogues like Donald Trump are going to have a field day in getting people to vote for them.
So is the problem then twofold, in the sense that the percentage of American workers in the private sector who are unionized has gone down from, I think, about 40% in the 1950s to about 7% today? And, of course, on top of that, there's this new war on public sector workers because the Republicans recognize that a lot of them give money to the Democrats. So they're both trying to break public sector worker unions and defund the Democrats in a 1-2 punch. So that's going on. But in terms of the Democrats being the traditional party of labor, they made a move around the time of Bill Clinton away from unions who simply because of the fact that they're losing clout in the workplace and they don't have the money they used to have, they made a move where the Democratic Party went after Wall Street money. And to my mind, that is an inherent problem. So in other words, if you got both political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, getting their money from essentially from Wall Street and plutocrats, the natural fit is with Republicans and plutocrats, whereas the Democrats have a more difficult task because they've got to lie to their base taking money from the same people that the Republicans get their money from. Am I identifying a central problem here?
Well, I think that it has been a problem for the Democratic Party. There's no question, turning their back on unions. And in many ways, I think you could actually take that farther back than just the Clinton years. I mean, I think that the Carter years are really the moment where Democrats began to turn their back on unions and not really support union-friendly policies in many cases. And, you know, Carter had the opportunity to push for significantly stronger pro-union legislation and chose not to. So I think it actually goes back quite a ways. And, of course, Clinton and Carter both come from the South, both come from states with very low unionization rates, both rose to power without a lot of help from unions. And so I think the problem is pretty complex, but I also think that, that ultimately, if you're going to win an election at any time, you have to get a majority of votes in a certain number of states. And Democrats were unable to do that, even though they got the majority of votes overall, but not in the right states. In no small part because, you know, in the new economy that these Wall Street people have helped create, it's an economy that has helped certain states and certain parts of the country and certain kinds of workers, but it has drastically hurt many other kinds of workers. And those workers live in states that have a lot of electoral power and a lot of electoral clout. So just from a strategic perspective, if Democrats do not have an answer to working class people in Michigan or in Ohio or in Pennsylvania, where they can be in their communities and have a job in their community that is going to pay some kind of a living wage, then they are very likely to lose those communities because Republicans are far more effective at demagoguing issues around race, around misogyny, and around other kinds of cultural factors that might, at least with white workers, might pull some of them, or in some cases a lot of them, into the Republican Party. And Democrats have simply been unable to articulate what does a post-industrial economy look like in a Youngstown, in a Harrisburg, in a Joliet, or wherever. What does that working class economy look like for actual people? And all this talk about retraining and education and, oh, maybe you should just move. These are not realistic solutions for the people who live in these communities. And that is a fundamental problem. And I think that relying on Wall Street and believing the Democratic Party did for a long time that Wall Street could kind of solve all of these problems and really just become a very similar party on economics in many ways to Republicans is a failed strategy. I think Democrats are finally figuring that out. It's a process to change that back. But the damage is being done every single day by the Trump administration to make workers weaker and weaker and weaker vis-a-vis the wealthy in this economy.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Loomis, who's a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money on labor and environmental issues. He's the author of Out of Sight, The Long and Disturbing History of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe, Empire of Timber, Labor Unions and the Pacific Northwest Forests. And his latest book just out is A History of America in 10 Strikes. So there is a couple of the Democratic presidential candidates, who one of whom is addressing exactly what you're talking about, of how to bring about an economic revival in the Rust Belt, and that is Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. And the overall perspective on labor is being provided by Elizabeth Warren, who seems to be the one Democratic candidate that keeps coming up with all kinds of proposals and policies which the others immediately seize on. And she has a sweeping plan to reinvent American labor and workers' rights and revive the middle class in something she calls the agenda for economic patriotism. So what's your sense of, is there a revival underway? I mean, in other words, the antidote to the false prophet of populism, Donald Trump, who's a con man, who got all these white working guys who are angry, justifiably angry, conned them, got their vote, then conned them, and now he's stiffing them. What do you think the chances are of an Elizabeth Warren or a Pete Buttigieg turning that around?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, I think that there are complex issues here. I mean, you know, part of the reason, you know, thinking about Warren here, I mean, piece of the reason that Trump won is misogyny, you know, and so that would be an issue against Warren as well, you know, and I think that could be a sometimes underexamined issue of why both men and sometimes women voted for Donald Trump. The idea of a true leader being a man, of a woman stepping out of her traditional role and playing this leadership role as somebody who is, quote, ambitious or whatever, which is never, you know, nobody would ever accuse a man of that. So I think that in terms of a given candidate, it's hard to say. I do think that in fits and starts, the Democratic Party is starting to get it. I think that candidates like Joe Biden don't necessarily get it. They don't quite really see what the real issues are at play here. And I think a lot of this sort of these candidates, and there's, of course, so many in the Democratic primary now, these sort of white male moderate candidates don't quite understand what's really going on. But I do feel very much that there are at least a few candidates who do get it. I mean, Warren probably more than any. I mean, Bernie Sanders certainly does as well. I do feel that the difference between the two is that Sanders is superb rhetorically. Warren is very good, on the other hand, at providing, as you pointed out, these detailed proposals. And I think that Warren also understands the reality of how hard it is to govern in America, and that, you know, just because a Democrat gets elected doesn't mean everything, even if it's a really great Democrat, doesn't mean everything gets fixed overnight. And I think that what she's doing especially is really articulating on all sorts of issues a ways forward that move beyond just rhetoric and toward really, really well-conceived and well-thought-out ideas about how the working class could move forward, as well as all sorts of other issues. So there is potential there. I think that there's a large base of the Democratic Party that absolutely wants this. We'll see how it goes going forward into the 2020 primaries. But, you know, I do feel there's still a lot of longtime Democratic politicians who rose up in this world of Wall Street fundraising and, you know, being effectively pro-corporate, who don't quite understand that the ground is shifting beneath them.
Well, I watched this really interesting town hall that Chris Matthews did a few weeks back in Pennsylvania. He chose the particular county that had voted for Obama and then voted for Trump in 2016. And there was a very passionate speech by a real burly kind of union guy who explained that he's a union man, he's with the electrical workers. His father was, his grandfather was, he's comes from a traditional union family. But he said, and he was addressing the head of the DNC, who was literally sitting there next to Matthews in the audience, and he addressed the head of the DNC, Tom Perez, and what he said was, he said, you know, you guys in the party are so obsessed with social issues and identity politics that, you know, you're not listening to me. You don't even know about me. You don't know about me and my people. He said, you know, to me, my job, my ability to feed my family and educate my kids, that's a social issue. So, and I thought, boy, he's really sending a strong message.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess there's a few things I think I would respond to on that. I mean, one is that all politics ultimately are identity politics. And I think that, I mean, I realize that, you know, the way has been talked about for years and years and years is that this is somehow, you know, that the politics of a white working class man is somehow different than other kinds of identity. And I don't think that's true. I mean, he's articulating his own identity, right, as a white worker. And he, you know, he has certain needs of his own. And I think that touches on larger issues about the way things are talked about in the media. You know, and it is interesting because, though, that you bring this up, because Perez himself really does get it. I mean, he was an excellent Secretary of Labor in the second term of the Obama administration, really the strongest Secretary of Labor in many, many years, but probably since the Johnson administration. And so, you know, Perez himself gets it, at least on some level. You know, but I think that there's a tricky situation here politically when we think about a guy like the person that you're describing. I think that people like that, and I think people generally want to see somebody who's going to fight for them, whatever that might be. And I think that was some of the appeal of Donald Trump. He seemed like he was going to fight for guys like that, saw Donald Trump, thought he was going to fight for them. And it's entirely possible that those guys might see an Elizabeth Warren and think that's somebody who's going to fight for me in a way that they did not with Hillary Clinton, because everybody knew that ultimately she wasn't really going to fight for that worker in, you know, wherever that town in Pennsylvania was, Erie or Scranton or whatever it was. And, you know, so I think that there is there's a desire to have somebody fight for you, and that's an important point. But at the same time, right, there are shifting priorities here. Even within, I mean, part of the problem Democrats face is that they are really diverse in terms of the electorate. So in other words, a Democratic Party, if it's going to win a presidential election, it's got to turn out African Americans in large numbers. It's got to turn out Latinos in large numbers. It's got to turn out women of all races. And it has to turn out, you know, it has to turn out enough working class white men too. So what happens when, for reasons that you want to, you know, and because you believe it, you're fighting against racism, you're fighting, you know, so that immigrant children don't get locked up at the border and all this other stuff, and you articulate policies that are pro-immigration, that are pro-black rights, that are pro-abortion rights, all these things, and you're also articulating policies that might be very pro-working class, but that white working class person may not be interested in any of those other policies. So it's a fine, in a diverse coalition like the Democrats have, it's actually a really fine line. How do you talk about all of these different issues in ways that don't alienate one sector of your coalition enough that they go and vote for Republicans because they dislike the rest of the platform? It's a really tough issue.
Well, Eric Loomis, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your perspective.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Loomis, who's a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money on labor and environmental issues. He's the author of Out of Sight, the long and disturbing story of corporations outsourcing catastrophe, Empire of Timber, Labor Unions, and the Pacific Northwest Forests. And his latest book just out is A History of America in 10 Strikes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.